Hey, Bobby Manning here with you on Dome Theory, the podcast, where we're going to talk to Kevin McCormick, as well as Derek Bodner, two of the people out in Philadelphia who cover their 76ers, and it looks like I'm not right about that team so far this year. I thought they were fooling everyone again. I thought the Doc Rivers signing was an arbitrary change at the head coaching spot. Now, Daryl Morey, as we can see so far, is an impact GM, an aggressive one, who was on the verge of trading Ben Simmons and acquiring James Harden, which would have shook up the East substantially. But to that point, we're already seeing the 76ers become the top team in the East through about 20% of the season, and the Celtics are in a series with them. So as we do here on this program, we talk to the opposing side, get to know teams around the NBA. I did a film breakdown in the Bodner part of this episode. Still stands, audio-wise, is a good conversation about Joel Embiid, who was off to an MVP start to this season. And the Celtics and them getting going in that first game where Philadelphia took a win in crunch time behind Embiid's 42 points. We talked about Kemba's return. He looked fantastic last week. That's going to change how competitive the Celtics are in the East if that continues. We talked a jump ball. I have never had to break down a jump ball and its execution by the referees in, let's say, 7 years covering the sport now. So that was new. That's how we let off our conversation. McCormick talked a bit about what's different in Philadelphia this year, and we'll see if it's different, truly, once the season concludes, once other teams make their moves, get to full strength, all these things. Philadelphia has fought through injuries and COVID to Seth Curry as well, so they are going to improve as this year progresses too. And who knows what they do with Ben Simmons? That's a big part of my chat with Bodner as well. Where does Ben Simmons fit in this whole equation with this team? But we'll leave that for the back end of the episode. I want to talk about Joe Biden, the President of the United States. We had the inauguration on Wednesday. And I believe Chris Wallace on Fox News said that back to JFK, which is the gold standard of inauguration speeches, full of, usually, I don't want to say bluster, that's too pessimistic, but optimism about the years to come, addressing the issues at hand by name, and then you hope that the president over the years to come solves them. Now, Joe Biden, not my preferred candidate from the Democratic side. I think anybody who follows me and discusses politics with me understands that there was a guy with mittens and a jacket who was making his way around the internet who would have been a little more preferable to people my age, certainly. But Biden offered incredible rhetoric on Wednesday, the kind that won this presidency with massive numbers, rebuked 4 years of stress, anxiety, depression, I think is the right word as well, under Donald Trump, and distrust, not only of him, the last president, but also from his supporters' perspective, institutions, truths, facts, things we generally agreed on. Norms is the word there, certainly. And I think people are overjoyed at the return of calm, tranquility. And unity is a tough word that I'm not going to cross over to. Now, Biden used it numerous times throughout this speech. I loved his allusions to helping each other out. When one person's day gets tough, there's other people whose days are going well that need to step up and do things within their individual selves to improve the country. I think he hit home this theme that, yes, we want the president, we want the Congress, we want all these things to deliver on policy that's going to positively change the country, especially COVID relief, which when I look at President Biden, that vaccines and a sense of trust and stability, probably to some degree, is going to be a victory in some sense. But the challenges in this country now, particularly on global warming, I'd say race, certainly, which is what I'm going to focus on here in this first segment. And I'd say infrastructure and the economy, certainly. The division of wealth in this country between the highest level and the lowest level, and how that under, you know, austerity measures and tax cuts and so many of the things that we've seen since the 90s when we last had a thriving, even economy, or more even than we have today. Those are big issues alongside the COVID one. So I think people are going to look at these four Biden years and say, if he hammers vaccines, if he gets us back to normal life, and if he erases a lot of mess that Trump left behind and pursues the people who circumvented the law in those years, which I certainly think is going to be important to finding this unity before we get into that, those are going to be successful Biden years. And I would tend to agree with that. But those other issues I mentioned are so fervent, so hot, so fiery right now that it's going to take a little more than all of that to put us back on a right path, truly. I think a race in particular, and I bring this up because Jaylen Brown has been so thoughtful and eloquent. Again, I hate to say those words because it implies that other players aren't, but it fits the bill with him, certainly, that he has led the way on, alongside LeBron James and others, on addressing these issues in press conference settings and in basketball games and over the summer, certainly, with the protests. But we can't make these protests for nothing. We can't make the momentum of the summertime when it comes to race and social justice a moment in time where people felt good and companies put out sentimental messaging to try to open themselves to a new demographic, which, again, that's the skeptic in me saying that Wrangler was putting out Black Lives Matter ads because, wow, we'd never reached black people before and now we have the chance to if we say something nice here. That's the thinking corporately behind a lot of the stuff we said. And I said on the Garden Report over the summer on CLNS that everything sentimental and great about that summer period had a bit of a corporate feel to it, a corporate capturing of a authentic movement, which eventually fizzled out and winter comes and the conversation gets left behind to some degree. But we need to continue that conversation. We need to make it real. And someone asked Jaylen Brown at practice yesterday, as I record this on Friday, his reaction in the inauguration. I think there's a sense among a lot of white reporters and white America in general that, you know, black people drove in this massive wave of votes to get Biden in office and bring the Senate back and all these things. There should be a celebration in the streets on Inauguration Day, much like we saw in November when he got elected. And Brown said, the feelings are complicated about this. I'm actually going to play the clip, but to sum it up, he likes that there's a sense of relief coming from Donald Trump's departure from office. But the power of the Trump era, and this truly will be what we look back on for my generation in particular, will be that it engaged people in a way, especially young people, I'd say, and probably former Republicans and this coalition that ultimately built the 80 million votes there, a disturbance to the vile rhetoric, the divisive policies, and in the end, an atrocious denial of the right to vote, which is what he ultimately tried to do for Philadelphia, Detroit, and Atlanta, to overturn an election. That engaged people in a way like never before, put their censors up. People were locked into the news, CNN, New York Times, hit all-time high in subscriptions. People were locked in, willing to talk about politics. We get politics inserted in sports in a way that we've never seen before, and a general sense that you can't opt out of this. If you're silent, silence is violence was the phrase used over the summer to some degree. And Brown looks at Biden and says, is this quiet figure, is this guy who we watch on the TV every day being more presidential, having a nice calming sense? And don't get me wrong, watching him address COVID the way he did and signing bills in a flurry and bringing Dr. Fauci out there to address these things certainly spoke and made me feel something. But there's another step beyond all this and a policy agenda that needs to be pursued that's going to take some aggression, going to take being opportunistic at this moment to the numbers in the House and all these different things. And Brown mentioned the glimmer of hope that we had before. 2008, Obama gets elected with both houses, the House of Representatives, Senate, and was racial change and progress fully realized during those years? Well, for whatever reason you look at it, not a single Department of Justice case was pursued in a police shooting of a black man during those 8 years, I believe, off the top of my head, if I remember that stat correctly. And, you know, again, I'm not going to sit here and blast Obama, those extenuating circumstances and a balancing act that he had to play and healthcare that he wanted to pursue, but that's that glimmer of hope Brown professed before that ultimately didn't turn into a slimming of the racial income gap in this country, police-related deaths, mass incarceration, those issues that need to be addressed so vitally during those years to come. So I'm going to play Brown before we get into our 76ers conversation here. But I'll say this about Biden and the sense of unity here. There does need to be a toning down of rhetoric, divisiveness, and tribalism in a way that we can't agree on anything. And I'm thinking, you know, my boss, Nick Gelso, always pushes me to try to find common ground with the other sides. And there's not much. I get an understanding of why both sides, from a survival standpoint, don't want to make this happen, don't want to engage, don't want to get involved with the other side at all. And win at all costs, as Brad Stevens put it a week ago. I love how I can frame these conversations through press conferences and conversations around the sport, but we got to widen beyond those too. We don't want to go through these 4 years after all the work that got done to get here and see nothing happen for young people, for everyday people in the country. And the skepticism of Biden, as good as right now feels, is that he's going to be affected by influences, by carefulness, by the party line, and just pursue minor change. And minor change isn't what's going to work at this moment. And we know how it goes. There's always a shift back to the other side in time. By 2022, there could be a Republican resurgence. They're going to accuse him of pursuing progressive policy and being a socialist and all these lines no matter what. So, again, there's certain things that just aren't going to be up for debate these next 4 years. We need to empower the people, we need fair wages, we need racial justice, and we need to agree that those things aren't up for disagreement. We need healthcare equality in this country. Like, those are just things people need. Infrastructure. Like, there's no getting around it, and the right to vote has to be enhanced above it all. There can't be this continuing attitude that there's a rigged election every time a Democrat wins, and in turn, it shouldn't turn back the other way if Republicans win, and there shouldn't be any rhetoric of a rigged election in that case. You know, and there are fair gripes about voting rights out there, but it can't go back the other way either. These are things that need to stop. So we need to continue to be engaged. We need to push unity, sure, but only unity with people who want to be part of this country and what it means. equality, justice, equal justice. Donald Trump and the people who fired up the storming of the Capitol last week, which indescribable. I don't know how people still look at that and think it's another day in politics or an overreaction or anything else. Those people need to be held accountable. Anyone who believes in that, anyone who continues to pursue Trumpism and that line of win or die politics, they're not going to be involved in this unity. Bad faith arguments are not going to be involved in this unity. People who have perpetuated racism and the continuing bigotry and disconnect in this country are not going to be part of this. There's a unity here, and Stephen Colbert said this well on his show last week. But for people who chasmed this unity, who drilled a hole in it, who spat on the idea of unity, they need to offer up something here. I'm looking at Mitch McConnell. I'm looking at Ted Cruz, those kind of people who contributed to and abetted Trump throughout the years, offered up the negation of Obama that opened the door to a figure who wanted to be the anti-Obama, and that was his only marketable offer that year. These people, deep in this hole, others have worked to seal the gap. And Biden, for all his hopefulness and possibly exaggerations of how possible unity and coming together in this moment, is working to do it as well in his own way. And I give him credit for that. But like Brown said, we can't stand down, we can't be too optimistic, and we can't feel like everything's just going to be okay. So enjoy the victory this week, certainly. I don't want to get too down on it, but there's a lot going on and there's a lot that needs to be done about it right now. And stagnancy, pursuing people who make bad faith arguments in opposition of progress and courting them as the sender of this conversation, we're not doing that. They can hop on this boat of American ideals, equality, justice, all those things, or they can get out, because we are not driving this country to appease Trump voters, make people who took an election loss feel better, or to stroke Mitch McConnell's ego. We're not doing that. We can find compromise. Tech reform. Republicans are leading a lot of lawsuits right now against Google and those type of things. That's the area where Nick inspired me to think about ways where we could come together. Certainly COVID relief has been the area in certain times. That's got to be priority number one right now, and maybe there can be some compromise there over what's addressed, but in general, there are things that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed now. And we can't wait 2 years trying to court as many Republicans as possible toward those causes. So I've gone on a little long here. I'm going to play Jaylen Brown's comments on this. We're going to get into our Philadelphia conversation. And then we will see you next week here on Dome Theory, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all those spots. Subscribe to the YouTube channel for watch the breakdown segment out of this episode. And I will talk to you next week.
I think that's a complex question. My dilemma was never with any presidencies or selections of different faces. It's more about the system, I think, that needs to be changed. So I definitely think I definitely think a lot of people feel at ease knowing that there is a different president that's going to be representing our country going forward. I know there was a lot of stress attached to our former president, potentially, but I definitely want to keep the same energy up in terms of having the awareness and pushing forward for change. We obviously have had glimmers of hope in the past, and they haven't necessarily panned out to any direct change. So I don't want this situation to be any different. I want people to still keep the same energy. And just because we have a new president doesn't mean the system doesn't need to be changed, and people need to be pacified or anything like that. We got to keep the same energy up. People still got to care. People still need to make phone calls, you know, et cetera. I'm looking forward to continuing to fight for change.
Bobby Manning here with Kevin McCormick covering the 76ers. Welcome back to Dome Theory here on the CLNS Media Network. We're going to preview the series. We're going to preview the inauguration. I don't know about that one, but let's get into the 76ers here. This series is getting underway. I love that we have a series between these two teams so early in the year. They're the two best teams so far in the Eastern Conference, and Kevin McCormick covers them with ESPN Radio. Great to have a voice of Philly here. I struggled all morning thinking of who I could have on from a Philly angle, because even though you just have these two fan bases always just throwing trash at each other and verbal assaults and the most vile back and forth you can imagine on the internet, I haven't gotten to, you know, talk to a lot of people who cover Philly on a regular basis, you know, give us some good insight on the team. And they have a good team this year. They've surprised me so far with the system that they've implemented defensively. They're a top five defensive rating team to start this year. Joel Embiid is sixth in Basketball Reference's MVP voting. So this team is intriguing. Now, Charles Barkley said they're a contender and Boston isn't. I don't agree with that one necessarily. You know, Boston's a half game up on Philadelphia. I don't know how you can get that, grasp that so far, but I do contend that Philadelphia has been the better defensive team so far to start this year. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, no doubt. And that just goes mainly with the, you know, when you have a team led by Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid who really pride themselves on that side of the floor, it's not very shocking that the Sixers have been the dominant defensive force that they've been. The main thing that's something, like you said, is just how night and day difference it's been from last season in terms of how the offense has looked. When you look at the additions of guys like Seth Curry and Danny Green, who really opened up the floor for Embiid and Simmons to create lanes, not to mention the hiring of Doc Rivers has done wonders for Tobias Harris on the floor. He's really starting to play at that near all-star level that he played as a member of the Clippers. And like you said, I mean, these are two top teams that are really going to make some noise in the East. So should be a good matchup and a good series.
Yeah, and we might get Tatum back for the second game, which is what we want to see. We want to see these teams going at each other at full strength. And these last 2 weeks were weird for these teams. Tatum comes down with COVID. Robert Williams on the Boston side is back for the first time tonight with COVID. He actually had a pretty scary experience, it looked like, with his whole family getting it, him coming down with the symptoms. And he had been one of the best bench players, you know, plus minus net rating, all that stuff in the NBA so far, Boston's best center. So it'll be good to have him back. But he had trouble guarding Embiid in that preseason matchup that we watched between the two teams. You mentioned you had gone to some of these preseason games. Tristan Thompson wasn't available for that one, so we'll actually get to see Thompson versus Embiid here. That's a big reason. Many would think that Boston brought in Thompson, have that big body defensive presence against an Embiid. And Enes Kanter did a good job against Embiid last year in that series that Boston ended up sweeping, having someone who could front, use some quick hands. Kanter's not the best pick and roll defender in the world. Like Thompson gives you a little more in that aspect. But I'm excited that Boston has someone who's a little more defensive minded overall now that Philly's getting in a little more pick and roll action, better ball movement, better spacing, all that stuff this year. Thompson hasn't blown me away so far. But what do you expect that matchup to look like between Thompson, between Embiid, the way Philly's playing to start this year?
To be completely honest, Joel Embiid has been at a whole nother level this year. Him being at the top of the MVP conversation right now is more than earned. If you look at all the performances he's put on this year, there's yet to be a defensive matchup where teams have been able to really slow him down. Even if you look at that Miami game, I mean, Eric Spoelstra was throwing triple teams at Joel Embiid at times. If he was
triple?
Getting,
three?
At times, yeah. They tried to zone up on him, and he was still getting everything he wanted on the floor. He has just been a man determined. And like I said at the top, you know, that improved spacing has done wonders for him. Now, you know, when you look at past years, teams have been able to do a better job of being able to double him. But with having guys like Curry and Green out there, you can't really sag off the perimeter threats like you could in previous years, which has allowed him to just attack matchups one-on-one. And there's yet to be a center matchup this year with Joel Embiid who's been able to slow him down. So in terms of that matchup, I still heavily favor Embiid.
For sure. And that you mentioned the spacing. Seth Curry comes in. One of the more underrated additions of the offseason. I looked at them and I said, all right, are two shooters, Danny Green, Seth Curry, going to change this whole thing up? Well, if you have a guy who's shooting 60% on catch and shoot threes, that's worthy of switching up the situation at hand there. They haven't had spacers like this. Korkmaz was probably as close as it came last year. And, you know, Green's pretty good in that aspect, 37%. But Curry is really the key right now, just lights out. Although he did come down with COVID, he missed some time over the last few weeks. We've seen guys come back slow, come back hampered by that. I don't know if you get a sense of what his experience was like. He might have just been asymptomatic and he's just going to come back and keep rolling. But other guys have had trouble with this. So that'll be one of the things I'm watching for tonight is, does Curry just keep playing lights out, keep drilling shots left and right for this team? Or is it going to be a slow integration back for him from COVID?
I would most likely assume it's going to be that slow start. I mean, he hasn't played since January 6th. So we're looking at about 2 weeks since he's been on an NBA floor. In terms of how he's been feeling, Doc Rivers has mentioned that he's kept in touch with him through the whole process of while he cleared protocol. And he said Curry's felt fine. You know, if you look at his Instagram stories here and there, he's been quarantined in his basement and he still had some workout equipment there. So I think he's been doing an okay job at, you know, trying to keep himself as physically ready as he can while he's in the situation that he's in. But if you look at the guys who were also out, you know, with players like Tobias Harris and Shake Milton, who also had a missed time while due to contact tracing, when they came back, they didn't miss a beat. So hopefully Curry can kind of fall into that suit as well. But, you know, it definitely will be a big thing to watch as they try and integrate him back into the system, if he'll be able to keep up at times.
So you mentioned the shooting. We know the defensive rotations have been tighter and Bede's coming back on a mission. That swept, or the sweep at the hands of Boston last year, definitely impacted him. Along with Snubs and, you know, among the top players in the NBA. The last year just seemed to have a extra push on his drive. And the conditioning certainly looks better with him. He's passing better out of double teams, triple teams, as you mentioned. So things just look different there. Obviously, some credit to Doc Rivers, defensive-minded coach, who has definitely helped on that end of the floor there. New voice probably for the team to tune into as well. But when you look at the team, when you talk to these guys, when you watch them close up, what's different to start this year?
There's just been a major culture change from top to bottom. I mean, as much as we can talk about the overturn of the roster that they've seen in the short offseason, you can look at the organization as a whole from top to bottom, from bringing in a guy like Daryl Morey to be your president of basketball operations, to not only hiring Doc Rivers, but Doc Rivers also brought in a phenomenal staff behind him. You're looking at guys like Sam Cassell, Dave Yeager, who, you know, they could be head coaches in their own right, defensive specialists like Dan Burke, Popeye Jones. I mean, you name it. It's just so many new, fresh, you know, eyes and ears on this team, and it's really paid dividends.
For sure. Now, Daryl Morey, always active, always aggressive. I thought this was going to be the team before the season started. It almost felt inevitable that Ben Simmons hasn't been the greatest fit with Joel Embiid. That's been evident. Last year, they lose him to the injury, so they never got that look at what they would both end up accomplishing in a playoff series together there last year. But it felt like if you had the opportunity to trade for James Harden, put him in a pick-and-roll combo with Embiid, become an elite ball handler, elite shooter, elite setup guy that Philly has needed in recent years, it was just going to be a no-brainer. And if you're Houston, you want to start with a cornerstone player, a guy who's been a number one pick, one of the best defenders in the league, like Ben Simmons has been. So it was stunning that they couldn't come to a deal. Now, Harden had his eyes set on Brooklyn. I'm sure there's some agent talks. I'm sure there's some pressure behind the scenes to make that go the way he wants it to go. But we also know that Houston wanted to just clear the books and, you know, get a guy like Oladipo who could be off the payroll by the end of the year. And, you know, we won't answer the Houston questions here. I have no clue why they didn't look at Philly and say, that's the way we want to go. But now you have a scenario. Remember, with Boston 2 years ago when Tatum's name, Brown's name were thrown around and Anthony Davis rumors. It certainly had an impact on the Lakers when they went through all of 2019 with the Kuzmas and the Ingrams and the Lonzo Balls having trade rumors floating over their heads. Well, now you have Ben Simmons, who's going to play out, you know, next few years of his career in Philadelphia, it looks like, now that this trade has come to pass. He's part of the core, but it feels like he was this close to being dealt. If Houston would play ball there, he was going to go to Houston and be cast off from this team, and it's always an awkward position when a guy gets left off. What's that going to be like? What's it been like so far? I know he's averaging 11 and 10, you know, assists and rebounds the last few games, so it hasn't hurt his play too much, but it's an awkward situation when that happens.
I definitely would say it's an awkward situation, but I think when you have a leader like Doc Rivers, I think it softens that blow a little bit. There definitely could have been, you know, some ripples at time. Ben Simmons did have some rough outings leading into the James Harden trade actually happening. So who knows? It could have had an effect on him mentally on the court and off the floor, you know, while all of these trade rumors were swirling over his head and around the team. But moving forward, I hope that he takes this as a confidence boost, you know, with Daryl Morey kind of drawing that line in the sand of where they weren't going to cross to acquire Harden. Hopefully that, you know, makes Ben feel a little better about himself that, hey, we still think you're a guy here. We still think you're a valuable piece and you can be something moving forward. So Doc Rivers has spoken about him with it. He said Ben's been feeling good about it. Ben spoke about it after a game last week and kind of said, you know, it's all part of the business. You know, star players get traded for star players. It's just the way of the league. So hopefully he takes this as a confidence boost and, you know, really tries to take it to his critics and show that he can take to a new level offensively. We saw against Memphis, he took 2 3-pointers and saw, you know, took the most jump shots in a game I think I'd seen him take in years. So hopefully he uses this as an opportunity to grow and understand that he's going to be a key piece here and that he still needs to, you know, drive and push himself and, you know, prove to people that they made the right move and staying put and wanting him around.
So how does he fit in right now? And now I'm looking at the numbers. I've watched the team a little bit. I love what Tyrese Maxey has done as a secondary ball handler on the team, coming in those bench units. And it feels like Simmons rotates into some of those bench rotations to be a bit of a ball handler, a playmaker with some of the bench guys like Danny Green and others there. That's why, like, Embiid just has this monster on-off number. And Simmons is a little more neutral. I think he's at 0 plus-minus between per 100 possessions. So he's shooting threes. That's a plus. I think he's taken 5 to start this year. He's hit 1. So you're going in a good direction with that as well. But you always think a guy who doesn't shoot a ton, guy who gets most of his looks in the paint, where Embiid operates as well, a driver, a transition player who isn't as good in the half court, there's still some awkwardness between the top two players on this team, which makes me hesitate to say that they're a finals contender, even though the early returns are looking good here. I think it comes down to your top talent. I think it comes down to, you know, how well your elite players mesh. And I still don't see a great level of cohesion between those two. Now, Embiid had a great press early in the year where he talked about them playing off each other, how it's going better to start this year. Simmons' numbers are good. I think he's 50% from the field. Ginormous rebounding assist numbers. So he's fitting in, but there's still that scoring question, where he's going to get his, how he's going to play off Embiid, because obviously this is Embiid's team at this point.
It's tricky to say where he can find his footing. If you look in the beginning of the year, it really seemed like he had found his footing in terms of just being the guy who wants to drive and kick. You know, it's something he's done at an elite level since coming to the NBA. Even though he doesn't shoot a ton of threes, he's created a lot of threes with the attention that he draws. So having guys like Danny Green and Seth Curry and Tobias Harris, having that original starting five back out there will allow him to show that he can still be an elite playmaker, and that's how he will affect the game on offense. His scoring numbers have taken a dip, but one thing that has increased is him getting to the free throw line more. So he's closing in on a career year in terms of getting to the line on a nightly basis. So if he can continue to keep that up and improve that percentage, that will help up his points a little bit. And just playing out in transition, that's what he does best. You know, he's a freak athlete with his size and speed, and very few players in the NBA right now can slow him in the open floor. So Doc Rivers has spoken a lot about playing at an increased tempo. So if Simmons can continue to just dominate in the open floor and take those opportunities to put his head down and get to the rim, continue to draw contact and get to the free throw line more, and, you know, just create that space and kick the shooters for wide open threes, you know, that's where he finds his footing within this offense.
So we brought on a new intern here in CLNS Media. Shout out to him, Jackson. He'll be helping us in the post-game show tonight. I was talking to him the other day, and I said, he's a 76ers fan. He's from the Philly area, goes to Temple. He says, I'm saying, you know, would you rather have Tyrese Maxey? Would you rather have Peyton Pritchard among these rookies that we've seen so far? I'm excited for that matchup here. He hesitated and leaned Pritchard so far. And I think the returns on those two so far, Pritchard has gotten the better of the two. So, you know, Maxey had that one huge game where the team was down to 8 and he scored 39, got to shoot upwards of 30 times. So Pritchard hasn't had that experience yet. He almost got it last week when the Celtics were down to 8 players, but never got the chance. He's been great so far. I'd say 10 out of 12 games he's been great, pushes the pace, awesome playmaker. But Maxey, I look at him. I look at Emmanuel Quickley out of Kentucky, and I say again, two Kentucky guys, just like Tyler Hero last year, who went a little bit overlooked and look like they're going to be one of the better players in this draft. Maxey's floater game is awesome. He gets to the rim. His dribbling is phenomenal. He's a playmaker. Defends, as we knew he would coming in. Now, shooting isn't his thing. That's something Philadelphia probably wishes they could get a little more out of from their first-round pick. But Maxey, Pritchard, watching those two early this year, what do you think that matchup's going to look like?
It should be interesting. I haven't seen much of Pritchard. I've seen a lot of, you know, just the box score watching and stuff, and he's definitely been a name that stuck out in this rookie class of guys that, if they did a redraft, would most likely get drafted a little higher. But in terms of Tyrese Maxey, he has been an absolute steal. And like you said, those Kentucky guards, they just come out ready. And when Tyrese Maxey got to Philadelphia, when he was asked about Coach Cal, he said that Coach Cal does a phenomenal job of getting these guys ready for the NBA. So I think what he does in Kentucky plays a huge factor of, you know, why these guys come in and are able to produce on day one. But Maxey's game, it's all downhill. He's just got a great motor. He's got a great feel for the game. Like you said, he came out and had that 39-point outburst against the Nuggets. There's yet to be a moment that he's been too scared of, and he's taken full advantage of every minute on the floor. And the jump shot isn't there yet, but it's coming along. He shows a lot of confidence of just stepping into the wide open ones and taking them. So hopefully they start to fall. But in terms of his whole offensive package, I mean, he has the potential to be a really solid three-level scorer. He plays well in the pick and roll, has a nice mid-range game. You mentioned the floater. That's great to watch. And just he has a phenomenal first step and just a nice burst to the rim that allows him to create space and, you know, really get some athletic finishes. So it should be a fun matchup with the rookie guards.
We're going to enter a golden era of the floater, I think. We're seeing teams attack into the paint, play drop defense. Philly does it. Boston does it a little bit here. They're not as much, but teams are packing the paint, trying to take that away. And guys like Maxey, Quickley, those floaters have just been so beautiful to start this year around the league, and teams are going to need them. Shot blocking's a big deal now. You're seeing some themes that players like Maxey and those guys are going to be able to thrive in this league for years to come because of that attribute of their game. Now, the Celtics, I've mentioned what I'm looking for from Philly. Can they stop Embiid? You know, defensively, do the Celtics stack up to par with Philadelphia in this matchup? I've been frustrated with Boston's defense to start this year. If you're looking at the Celtics in this series, what do you think they're going to do to test Philly? What are you going to watch from Boston's angle that you want to see Philly be able to handle?
The main thing for me, especially heading into the night with no Tatum, is, you know, trying to contain Jaylen Brown, because he's been a guy that's been playing at a great level. He's, you know, continues to take more leaps as his career develops, which, you know, is a great sign to see for Boston fans. But he's definitely a guy to watch. You know, you just got Kemba Walker back. He's going to be another one to watch. So just containing the star players, I think, should be the major focus, just because looking at these rosters in terms of depth, for the first time in a while, I think the Sixers might actually be a deeper team than the Celtics. So if you can contain that star power and really take advantage of your depth, I think the Sixers could walk away with this series.
Wednesday, which is tonight, 7 o'clock, these teams get at it. 7:30 on Friday, he is Kevin McCormick. You can follow him at KevinMCC973 on Twitter with ESPN Radio in Philly. Great to talk to you. Great to get to know you a little bit here. And we'll chat on Twitter. We'll talk about the game. And it's about to be a big speech in America, so we'll let everybody go and watch that. Thanks for watching. Anybody who tuned in live here, you can get it in full at CLNS Media if you didn't get the first part of it. And make sure you subscribe to Dome Theory as well for the podcast version of the Spotify, Stitcher, all those places, iTunes. Appreciate you, Kevin. We'll talk to you soon.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Derek Bodner, we have a friend here today from Sixers Beat, covers the 76ers, has written for a variety of platforms. Great to have you here. Great to have an expert on the 76ers. Celtics Sixers is always a fun time. We get twice the action here. And the first game didn't disappoint, but I'll ask you first, since I'm just getting to know you here. I always like to get into why, you know, the people I talk to on these different shows gravitated toward the teams that they did, became interested in covering those teams, came up. You know, you've written for a variety of platforms in Philadelphia. For me, the Celtics, it was always the culture, you know, 2014, the hustle, the tenacity they played with, the comebacks in a lot of those games in the early Brad Stevens era led me to cover the team. But for you, what got you interested in the 76ers and what kind of captivated you to cover about them?
I mean, I've lived in the Philadelphia area most of my life. So when I started writing about basketball, it was natural to debate and discuss them. I didn't go to school for being a writer. I sort of just faked my way in. So it was just natural to talk about the hometown team.
Yeah. AI? I thought you were going to say AI.
Well, I mean, I certainly I was in high school and early college during the AI era. Certainly I watched a lot of him for sure. But I mean, in terms of like, I'm a Philly guy. I follow all the Philly sports. It's just sort of the way it is.
Who's the most captivating Sixer you've followed, you've watched, you've covered to this point? Does Embiid get up there at this point now?
Embiid's up there, but it would certainly be AI. I mean, that guy had just a magnetic personality. Even just watching him play, the energy and the passion that he played with, and then also he was. It's sort of lost in today's NBA and today's just sort of sports media environment. There was as flawed as he was, there was a rawness to the way he expressed his emotion. And I think he was far and away the most captivating athlete in recent Sixers history. Embiid's great, but he's not in terms of just the sheer connection. He's not where AI is.
I think of the artistry of him too. AI, Melo, others of that era, you know, Paul Pierce, they all kind of had this distinctive style that you recognize. And sure, for the people who hate the game now, I don't hate the game now. I love the energy. I love the scoring, love the offense, the flow. But you do lose that distinctive style. And we're going to talk a lot about Joel Embiid here. We're going to watch a lot of what's made him an MVP candidate start this year. But he's closest. There's probably a few in today's game. Damian Lillard, for sure. Curry, who have a distinctive style that's going to stick out all the time. But Embiid, his post game, his ability to play inside out, that stuff, people aren't going to forget it. But we'll start here.
Yeah, for sure.
With the jump ball, which is, I did not think was going to be the story of last night, but Marcus Smart said, go back and look at it. So this is what we're going to do. You don't think of this often, that refs, they got to throw these jump balls from time to time, and they always have to be perfect. And for the first time ever covering basketball, I heard a player complain that the jump ball was biased. And of course it was Marcus Smart. So we'll take a look at this. I didn't see it, but I don't know. Let's see what you think about this one.
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly towards Danny Green's side. Certainly a little, but I would bet that happens quite frequently. Like throwing a ball straight up probably doesn't happen all that often. But yeah, no, it drifted a little bit for sure. For sure.
It drifts a little. Yeah, it drifts. So, like, I don't know what the rule. Could they re-jump that? Could they? I don't know. I guess that it just does happen and players don't call attention to it. But 3:07 left, 4-point game. It ends up being a bigger play than you would usually see out of a jump ball here.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Jump ball decided. Marcus Smart had a point. He complained about quite a bit out of this one. Celtics didn't like the free throws. I think it was 15-0 advantage in the fourth quarter. So I did want to get back into Joel Embiid drawing crunch time free throws. This is one they actually reviewed here on Daniel Tice. I thought this was a good call.
Yeah, but when you lock arms like that, you're going to get called a lot.
Yeah. That's what Marcus Smart said after the game, flopping around.
is what.
Yeah, I mean, like when two people lock arms like that, like it's going to get called. And frankly, I don't want to hear it from Marcus Smart about flopping, because that dude is he's a self-admitted flopper. I think there was it was with Rachel Nichols a couple of years ago where he sat down and goes, yeah, that's a flop. Like, yeah, it's like offensive players can draw a foul. I'm going to draw a foul too. So for him to complain about it, like, does Joel Embiid embellish a little bit? Sure. But you are not the messenger for that.
No, discussion. For sure. And Daniel Tice, it's funny, Daniel Tice always ends up in these situations. We've seen him and Embiid go at it quite a bit the last few years. And when you have a guy who's probably, I'd say 250, I think, is Tice's listed weight, seems a little generous.
Yeah, well, even so, Embiid's got him by 40 to 50 pounds.
Yeah. So that's always been a physical matchup that Tice has had trouble keeping up with. How do you feel? So this is a thing in Boston, the war on Tice. You know, you have Brian Scalabrine talking about it on the broadcast now. I think last year he was one of the 10 most per minute foulers in the NBA.
Okay.
So he's definitely a fouler, is how I've always seen it. Like, he fouls a lot, and he ends up in a lot of situations where you can say, oh, is that a good call? Is that not a good call? And it sort of developed this thing. There's a war on Tice. There's always bad calls going against them. And I've seen a few over the years, certainly. But I always go back to, if you foul a lot, you're probably going to get called for some that aren't fouls too. And that goes back to Smart too. That's another guy who always ends up in these situations flopping. And when you put yourself in those positions a lot, you're going to be subject to some bad calls.
Yeah, and we sort of go through that with Dwight Howard here too. I would bet you Dwight probably fouls more per minute than Tice does. Especially a lot of these backup, you know, big men who aren't necessarily in their roles because they're super skilled. Well, I like Daniel Tice. But part of that is that you've got to be a high energy defensive anchor, or at least a guy who can orchestrate a defense a little bit. And that's just, it's prone to picking up fouls.
And he had a good game. He certainly was the Celtics' best option in this one, which was surprising. But what I find interesting about Embiid, and of course the foul is where the conversation, he gets 21 free throws, I believe, yep, in this one. He puts himself in a great position, is what I always say, to get fouled. And this is something that he's done a little more frequently to start this year, and why he's been so dominant, it feels like, is he's going into the post, embracing contact. He's always done this, but he also has a great jump shot that he likes to rely on. He likes pulling up from three, from the mid-range. But what you see at the end of this game is when he plants himself in the post, gets in isolation, he can draw free throws again and again, yep, and again. So 21... it looks like a ton on paper, and especially when the other team has zero in the fourth quarter, that's going to be a conversation. But what is it that gets Embiid to the free throw line, you think, as much as he does?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's very, when you reach your hand down, he's very good at the rip through to get your hand caught up in his and to get what is a legitimate foul, but a bit of a cheap foul. And I think that's probably where a lot of this discussion comes from. Like, he is smart in an almost Harden-esque way for a big man to make sure that you make contact. And if your hands are out of position, he is going to do that. So the combination of just his sheer physicality, his sort of instinct and knowledge on how to draw fouls, and when defenders are in pretty compromised positions with their hands, all of that is pretty, I mean, it's just, and I mean, the NBA has gone away from big men. So there just aren't that many big men who are capable of matching up with him in the post anyway. And that has all sort of just created a pretty good foul drawing machine. He's very, like, if you watch the way he, I mean, like I said, the rip through, he goes to constantly, and he will get your hand stuck in a spot where it's going to get a foul. I would be annoyed by it if I was another team, but it's, a lot of them are legitimate calls. There is contact. He just takes advantage of it.
It wasn't the best pace game we've watched all season when it comes to calls.
No, it wasn't.
Wasn't grateful. We'll see how Friday looks. So forget the fouls. I hate that conversation, but we had to do it with how much it got brought back. His passing is what sticks out to me this year.
Yep.
He's making great reads out of double teams. He's done a lot of this stuff, but I think what's key for him in his MVP case this year is that he's doing all these things more consistently. And he only had two assists in this game, but they were both fairly impressive. to me. Double comes.
Well, and a lot of these, this one, because I saw this one earlier, this is going to be a hockey assist where they get an open three.
Yeah.
And it's because of him. He'll never get that assist, but it's all because of him.
It all comes out of the flow of the offense. Yeah. So that wasn't one of the assists there. The two ones, one was kind of a dish to his left to Danny Green, which I believe is right here. You know, a simple one here, but still a great play nonetheless. Gets into his post up on Thompson, and we'll talk about Thompson's defense in a bit, but not a ton of resistance there. Smart comes, Green right to his left, hits the three. What, spacing's better this year for sure. You got a Green, you got Seth Curry, who did not play in this game. There's a lot more free space, guys who can hit off these kind of plays, which would help Embiid as well. But what else you've seen in the offense that, you know, they're not elite offensively, but it feels like they've been a little better to start this year.
Yeah, this whole NBA is a weird year because people are in and out of lineups. You're playing some games with half your team, and you guys have gone through that as well. So some of these early season numbers are strange. But in terms of Embiid, I mean, the spacing is huge. Like, the fact that you replaced, you know, Josh Richardson and Al Horford, who I like, but who's not a high-volume corner three-point shooter, replacing them with, you know, Danny Green and Seth Curry. And Seth Curry might be one of, if not the best, catch and shoot shooters in the league. Those are massive upgrades. And now you got Shake Milton, who at this point last year wasn't in the rotation. So those three players are very good fits next to Embiid. And last year, you know, I think you can make a very strong case that last year's Sixers team had more talent than this year's Sixers team, but they didn't fit their best player nearly as well. And I think that's helped him in terms of passing. You know, those double teams, and Boston was great at this in previous years, they wouldn't fully commit. They'd get like halfway between Embiid and their man, and they were comfortable doing that.
It's cheating. Yeah, they just cheat a little
because
bit.
Because they just weren't afraid of the Sixers shooters, and they felt like they could recover. And they could then play off of him and sometimes attack, sometimes not, sometimes dig down all the way and force a turnover, sometimes not. And Embiid's talked about this. He didn't have confidence that who he was going to kick out to was going to make the shot or even make the right play. And now he does. And he's just going in there with a plan of attack. Like in previous years, he reacted to double teams. Now when he has the ball, he's planning the pass. He's planning the kick out. He's planning where he wants the double team to come from much more than he was in previous years. It's just, you know, I think this is one of the things where it's a combination of spacing around him and also it just clicking. And I think this is the one aspect of his game that hadn't clicked yet. And I think it's starting to now.
I can't wait to press play on this one. This was beautiful here. You forget a nice little dish to your left. You know, anyone can do that out of a double team. The guy comes from the left, dish to the left corner three. This was probably the best pass I've ever seen him make.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one where in previous years, he would get rid of balls too early. And I swear, sometimes he would forget that he's 7'2" and he can lift the ball up and very few people are going to get to it. But like sometimes, like right there where he's holding it, he's turning that ball over. He's calmed down a little bit, which is nice. He still almost fell out of bounds, but.
And what I see too, I think on the last pass was there's some hesitation. You know, you can't do a shot fake from here, but earlier the shot fake kind of pulls in the defense a little bit. And you see the Celtics, you know, they're tilting to the left a little bit. You have the nice high screen from Simmons there that keeps Green away from Green, coincidentally there. And, you know, that's the help of having a guy like Green. I wasn't sure that Green and Curry would change this team transformatively, especially because those aren't great defenders. You know, Green's good, but Curry's not the best.
Well,
but,
and Green's not what he was 3 or 4 years ago even,
But they just had so little shooting that even just adding a little bit, and Curry's been a lot, but you add a little bit in Green, it just makes a world of a difference.
And it's not even just the sheer percentages, because, like, Al was a good shooter on the percentages, especially for a center. Josh, before he got here, was an acceptable shooter the previous 2 years, but it's the volume, it's the hesitation. Like, there was so much, even when Al shot, there was hesitation in a shot. Even when Josh Richardson shot, you know, first of all, in the beginning of the year, there was hesitation, but then he started missing. And then it was like pump fake, jab stick, couple of dribbles into a mid-range, and it just, the Sixer spacing just cratered. Because like I said earlier, like, there was so many teams that they felt like even if they, like, they could always recover back to Josh Richardson. They don't feel like they can do that with Seth Curry and Danny Green.
So let's talk Ben Simmons. most another captivating character. We could throw him up there in the list too of captivating Sixers. The don't shoot, all that kind of stuff piles up against him. Feels like stuff gets in his head. Now all of a sudden you have trade talks enveloping the team. The Harden deal felt this close. If Houston wanted to do it, it felt like Simmons was going to be a rocket. And now he has to come back and fit in with the team and, you know, be a Sixer for the long term after this. And the stuff can fade, but as we saw with the Celtics and the Lakers during Anthony Davis talks, it can linger a little bit. But the fit is still the biggest question with him. I believe he's got a career low points per game. Mm-hmm. And there's always that talk of the fit with Embiid. Embiid's clearly the centerpiece of this team. Everything's going to be around him. So now it's, how does Simmons fit in around him? I think the Sixers coming into this game are outscoring opponents by 20 points with Embiid on the court. With Simmons on the court, it was net even. So they're not finding the best spots for him. But I look at a play like this, there is possible room to have two guys navigate the post. And Doc Rivers said before the game too, you know, you can post up from both sides. There's enough room in the post for two guys, but it's not always the best way to run a modern offense. It works well here, but you don't see it consistently create plays like this.
And this one, it started off with Simmons in the post, but really it's a snug pick and roll.
Yeah.
And they do that so they can get that deep pick and roll where it's much harder for somebody to go under a screen because you're so close to the basket. So you saw there, they switched. When that happens, you know, either Simmons has a slower guy he can take off the dribble, or Embiid has a, in this case, very much smaller guy that he can post up, and it works. But they're, you know, they do that so that it's a little tougher to go under the screen. And that's when they run Simmons in pick and roll, and they don't run a whole lot of pick and roll with Simmons. They and like to like, do it.
Why?
In that
why don't they do more?
Well, I mean, from the perimeter, it's really like he just, it's tough when you can go so far under the screen like that.
Yeah.
But that's where they try to overcome it, isn't a play like that.
Well, we know what he's good at. This is the play of the night. Oh, hold on.
Yeah, I mean, he can get out for sure. There, I mean, that was.
Did you know Korkmaz had that in him?
Well, he actually, if you go back and find on YouTube, he won a EuroLeague dunk competition in a Darth Vader costume. So he has some ups in the open court. Now, he doesn't elevate all that well in traffic. But he can get up there in the break. Yeah. And what I like about Korkmaz is despite the fact that he is a deep bench player, 9th, 10th man on the team, he has a little bit of flair to him, whether it's this reverse dunk, he loves behind the back or through the legs or behind the back pass, probably more than he should. When he gets going, he can be fun, but when he's missing his shots, he can be, not, yeah, Simmons, I mean, it's been a tough year. Like, he had a knee injury that kept him out of the Boston series, obviously, last, what, was that summer? Was that fall? It's such a weird schedule. During the Celtics series.
During the playoffs, yeah. He was
a very brief playoff series.
Yeah.
But he had that knee injury, which kept him out. That same knee kept him out of a game or two here, two games earlier in the season, maybe about 2 weeks ago. So it's bothering him a little bit. I think it's probably bothering him a little bit more than he's letting on. I think that's part of the reason why he is struggling the way he has. But I think he's also just not confident as a scorer right now. I mean, he gets into really good position on some of his drives, 5 feet from the basket, and he won't go up with it. And he's been struggling so far for sure.
And he had a tough time with Brown in this one. I'm not sure if this is the clip necessarily. No, Harris is on him here, but Brown has been rolling at a high rate to start this year. Getting off the dribble is a big thing for him. Scores through Dwight Howard here. He did a ton of great work in this game off the dribble and had a phenomenal game for three quarters. I thought he faded a little bit in the fourth and ends up with not the greatest shooting line, but he gave Simmons trouble for certain stretches of this one. Now he draws Harris here. Harris has covered Tatum with this team as well. It's always interesting, who does Harris get, who does Simmons get? Simmons isn't on the floor here, but for most of the game, Simmons was guarding Brown, and you know, I'd call Simmons one of the three best defenders in the league, and Brown was able to get him. There was another play as well where he really crossed him up on the dribble and pulled up from two. I think Brown's one of the best two-point shooters in the league from the mid-range this year. So the layers of Brown's games just keep piling on each other. And
it's amazing. I remember watching him at Cal, and there's probably no player I've been more wrong on in the draft than Jaylen Brown. At Cal, he just looked like he had no idea what he was doing. Like, and I think part of that was they had real bad floor spacing, and part of it, like, things just hadn't clicked. But he made so many bad decisions during his 1 year at college, and I was way off. well. And to be honest, he's gotten so much better that it's tough to even know what the eval was. He's just improved by leaps and bounds. But yeah, Simmons definitely had a tough, tough time defensively the other night. He hasn't looked the same defensively here over the last couple of games. I think part of that is the knee injury. He isn't changing direction. He isn't building up speed the way he previously was. And sometimes you just have to tip your hat to a good offensive player who's making plays too.
We're going to put in that Jaylen play after. I can't believe I didn't clip that one, but you know which one I'm talking about, the crossover pull up. Great, great play. Another player who was able to break down Philly's defense here. Kemba Walker is back, looking phenomenal in the pick and roll, breaking down Philly's defense here. Most of the first half, he was a menace off the bounce. And his hesitation in the pick and roll, his timing and finding guys on that roll. He's not the best passer in the world, but what I'm seeing most from him in two games so far back from his knee treatment is he can generate an amazing pick and roll, both for himself off the shot, which has killed Philly's defense going back to their playoff series, but also getting guys on the short roll here and just opening up the offense altogether. They ended up putting 4 sixers in the post here on this play.
Well, even going back to his Charlotte days, he's always killed the Sixers. I think he had 60 against them maybe 2 years ago, something like that.
It's because they drop. That's always been when they drop against them, and he's the best pull-up shooter.
Well, and I mean, the Sixers are a little bit more aggressive in their pick-and-roll coverage this year, just a little bit more, not super aggressive. But, I mean, when you're starting that pick-and-roll 27, 28 feet from the basket and you're playing Dwight Howard and Joel Embiid, there's not that many options you have. You don't want – even right there, Embiid's not really in position.
I love Embiid getting pushed off right here.
Yeah.
Just getting sent flying back into the post.
But, I mean, it's they've never really figured out the Kemba pick-and-roll. And he made some tough shots last night. So he's a tough guy to guard, for sure.
Great to see him look this good.
And I mean, in here you've got Tyrese Maxey, a rookie. Kentucky didn't play against Kemba Walker's last year, so it's a little bit of an adjustment for him. For sure.
Kemba has a great game. Minutes limit kills Boston in this one. Tatum's not out here, so I wasn't freaking out about this loss. Crunch time was tough. That Danny Green offensive rebound was a tough one to swallow. That got the second chance point down the stretch. But just overall good stuff here. I think Kemba unlocks Daniel Tice to a significant degree too. Love this feed from him here on the roll. Saw quite a bit of those. I believe Tice had upwards of 20 points in this one. And he's a tough guy to contain on that roll. I thought Dwight Howard got picked on a bit, not only by Kemba, but Jaylen Brown got him a few times on these pick and rolls too.
No, I mean, the Sixers defense, they started off the first 8 games or so. They were, I think, the number one ranked defense in the league. Then they went through some COVID spells where they lost a bunch of people, and Embiid and Simmons went out with injuries, and they just haven't looked the same here in over the last 2 weeks. This was not a great performance by them from any stretch. Like you said, if Kemba's not on a minutes limit, forget about Tatum. They probably pulled that game out. So I think the Sixers have some work to do. Seth Curry is coming back for the next game. It sounds like, I think he's upgraded to probable, and he will help them offensively, but he's not solving any of these problems. Defensively, they need to get back on the same page because they have not executed on that end here over the last 2 weeks, for sure.
I think you said at the beginning of our segment here that doesn't feel like any team in the NBA right now likes their defense. No. So that makes everybody feel a little bit better. The Celtics haven't defended by any means to start this year. Again, last night, giving up 42 to Embiid, of course. But I look at Tristan Thompson, and you would think he would be a guy who would be able to command more resistance a little bit against an Embiid. And I don't love his positioning. Again, I don't think this play here was him breakdown. Kemba gets caught around, Embiid goes to set a screen there, doesn't actually end up setting it, and they're just scrambling to find Harris at the last minute. But I look at the second play here that I have queued up, and you would think he'd just be able to stay with Embiid a little better, fronts him well. But this is where I see him getting caught again and again, contesting shots. Got killed by Durant to begin the season on switches like this. And he's so groundbound and doesn't have great height either that it feels like guys have a decent time if they just put a little body on him and get a shot over him. They can do it. And again, he had a hamstring injury. He's another guy who's coming back. So I'm not going to kill him right away, but I thought there would be more impact from him. Last night, I think he had 2 points, 5 fouls, and was a minus 12 against Embiid.
And I mean, Embiid, like we focus so much on his post game, like he's got really good touch from the mid range and a really high release. Yeah. And if you're a shorter player, like there's not too much you can do on that one. When he's got it going on, he's tough. I'm sure Daryl Morey would love to see him extend that out to the 3-point line a little more consistently. That mid range shot is probably not what an analytics guru is really looking for.
I love it though.
But Embiid is, I mean, Embiid's real good at it. And because he can draw a double team and his passing's better, it makes that calculus a little tougher.
That's Watch the Breakdown. He is Derek Bodner. You can listen to him weekly on Sixers Beat. Appreciate you being here. Read them on The Athletic as well. The Athletic, feels like all the friends we roll through here coming from The Athletic. So subscriptions are well worth your price there. Thank you, Derek. We'll talk to you again in the playoffs, probably, yeah. I'd imagine.
I mean, 3 or 2 out of the last 3 years, so probably. Thanks for having me.